chillin', Anna. You will hear about the eliminating of the negative and an accent on a positive.
Gather round me, chillin', if you're willing, and sit tight while I start reviewing.
Test, test. Is this thing on? Oh, yes, it is. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the podcast, The Joyful Frugalista, and now here's your host, Serena Bird and friends.
Hello, Frugalistas, and welcome. This is another podcast that I'm recording in Melbourne, and I have a very special guest with me today. His name is Jason Nemovsky. Welcome.
Thank you. It's very good to be here.
This is my first time to meet Jason, but coming into our Airbnb feels a bit like home for you, doesn't it?
It does. I lived about four floors beneath the place that we're in today.
I know, it's weird. So, of all of Melbourne, and oh, I chose an Airbnb where you used to live.
A bit creepy, actually.
Well, we're not stalking you. I had no idea about that until yesterday. But why we're speaking to Jason is one of my very good friends has been working in Melbourne for a couple of months, and she sent me a message a week ago, and she said, you have to talk to Jason. You have to talk to Jason, and not only that, but you have to get him on your podcast. And I went, that's very nice. What's so special about Jason? And she started to tell me a few things, and I went, yes, I definitely need him on my podcast. Jason is a mid-career Commonwealth public servant. He's currently in Melbourne, although he hasn't always lived in Melbourne. He's fairly new to Melbourne. But he has a really interesting story about money and finances, probably quite different to a lot of his peers of people he works with. I guess it's kind of a different secret double life in a way. Would that be?
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's definitely not something I openly talk about, at least in the workplace or with friends, unless I'm prompted. It's, I think money is still, talking about money openly is still a bit of a taboo, in some groups. And it's a challenge to find your tribe, to find people who are like-minded, who are interested in building wealth or getting value out of money. It's something that it's sometimes a lonely journey.
It is. It can be.
Yeah.
I know when I was on posting to Taiwan, I used to get the Money magazine as a subscription. And a number of us that worked together, we'd get different magazines and we'd pass them around the office. So Women's Weekly was always really, really popular. And so was Delicious magazine. My Money magazine, nah. And yep. I was like, don't you want to know about this? Like, why are you at work? And I know there are a lot of good reasons to work. It's a contribution you're making. It's something often you're passionate about. It's a sense of purpose, socialization. But basically, it's a contract. You go to work, you perform a service, you get paid. So, like, why is there so much kind of stigma or disinterest even about making that remuneration go as far as possible?
Yeah, I think about that a lot, and I think part of it is about our education, the foundation of what we've learned about money management. Thinking about school, we were taught in our commerce classes how to use a credit card, how to make repayments for a loan and things like that. But really we weren't taught about why it's important to save and build for your future. And it's just something that I think it's something that you have to choose to be interested in as well. It's certainly not something for me. It's not something that my parents were particularly interested in.
You weren't getting this kind of interest in finances or this grounding from your parents. Where were you getting it from? Like, what was the light bulb kind of moment for you, or the things that got you? What got you really interested in finances?
Yeah, sure. In the beginning, as a child, I had two grandparents who were highly influential when it came to money. So I'm half Macedonian. So my father's side of the family is Macedonian, and my grandfather migrated to Australia in the early 60s. Mm-hmm. Didn't have a lot in the beginning, and worked very hard all his life and at the steelworks down in Port Kembla. And he instilled a great deal of importance on the value of a dollar. And I watched and observed how he would handle money, how he would respect it. And it started to make me think about what it can do for you. and why it's important to think about why you're earning money and also mm-hmm. and also the reasons for spending it. And then my, you know, on the mother's side, on my mother's side of the family, my grandpa was very focused on supporting us from an education point of view because he understood that the link to success in life is a good education.
That's an interesting one. As a mother of two children, I agree. Although I do think that modern education has changed a little bit. It's now less about learning facts because, you know, you can go into Google and ask Google anything. What is whatever equation or what is whatever fact? It's now more, I think, about having some resilience and confidence and that inquiring mind.
Yes. Yeah, it's the soft skills, I suppose, as it well. Is. And yeah, and it's not exactly things that can be taught through reading books or sitting in a class as well. It's through life experience. I guess more recently in my early 20s, I got gifted a book called Zero to 135 Properties in, I think it was 3 years or by Steve McKnight.
Oh, I have read that book many yes. years ago now, but it was very popular in its day.
Yes, it was the number one bestseller in his category, in the property investing category, I think. And while the story that Steve talks about is one story about going up to Ballarat and buying a house for, I don't know, whether it was like $60,000 and the scheme that he set up to, or the model that he approached himself. It was just the fact that just being able to learn about different ideas and yes. different ways, strategies yes. that people use, I wasn't trying to figure out someone else's idea and replicate exactly that. It was about broadening my mindset and trying to understand the different approaches people take to managing money, and also the trigger point, the turning point for why people are doing that. So Steve McKnight was an accountant, mm-hmm. A professional accountant, and he had a turning point where he decided, you know what, I don't want to do this for the rest of my life. The next 40 years, I don't feel excited about this. I'm not saying that I'm not excited about my life as it is, but I think from in my early 20s, I really seriously thought about what my life, how I was going to retire in my life already at that point, which is really weird.
It just gives you choices, I think. Yeah. Looking back on my own career, and I know we've talked and there are some similarities, although not quite the same. But, you know, there's some things that I've really enjoyed and there's some things that have been amazing. But then there's some things that really was very awkward for me last year when I had a bullying issue in my workplace that unfortunately triggered memories of the domestic violence that had happened about 5 years beforehand. I was able to say, well, do I really want to come into work every day and have to deal with this and deal with the anxiety it's putting on me and how it's making my body respond to that and how that's impacting on my family? And the answer was, well, no. Guess yeah. what? I don't have to deal with this. Mm. And it's very liberating when you have those choices, because I'm very aware, particularly as the economy is turning, that not everyone does have those choices. You have to kind of just suck it up sometimes.
That's right. And everyone has a different set of circumstances exactly. that they come into. And something that I've said to friends before when they find out more about my situation is they feel a little bit envious, I suppose, about what I might have achieved, and myself feel uncomfortable to even say that because of what we're taught to, I don't know, I guess it's not something we talk a lot about, but I always say to people that it's incremental decisions that you make throughout your life.
It is.
That get you to where you are. It's not just about looking at the Steve McKnight approach and going, okay, well, I'm going to do exactly that and then I will become a millionaire. It's, for me, it was about very, very small little things that establish your core set of values on how you approach money and where you see, how you see your future.
Let's take us back to a very big decision you made when I think you were 21.
Okay, so when I was 21, I was living in Sydney, which is where I'm from, and I was living with my parents in Wattle Grove. And I had a friend that I met while I was on a study abroad program in San Francisco. And she moved to Sydney and stayed with my family as well. And we decided that we both wanted to buy an apartment together.
So you were 21. How old was she?
She was 22.
So it's 20, big difference. So she was much older, I can see, a whole
much
year.
Much more wiser.
So 21 and 22, and you want to buy an apartment in Sydney.
To be honest with you, the year before that, I was still in San Francisco and I was going to stay for another semester, but I decided to come back early because I wanted to do this. Because
wow.
I was so focused on coming back, getting back to work. So I studied and worked full time and I wanted to work and save more money to get that deposit.
And to make that happen.
So you
were studying full time and working full time.
Yep.
So that you could have this goal at age 21
yep.
of owning an apartment
yep.
in inner city Sydney.
So I worked 4 days a week, but I worked 12-hour shifts at a five-star hotel in Sydney, shift work. And then amongst that, I jammed in my classes. That's just how I made it work at the time. It's not something I would ever be able to do now. Yeah, so we each had a $20,000 deposit and we bought an apartment, a two-bedroom apartment in Surry Hills in 2007 for $404,000.
Wow. Do you still have that apartment?
No, we sold it. We sold it in 2014. So we spent about $20,000 updating it with a new kitchen, flooring and painting. We sold it at auction for $851,000.
That's not a bad return.
Yeah. We were in the upstairs bedroom when the auction was happening and we had set the reserve at $750,000. So we thought that we would be very, very lucky to get that price. And then on the day, as you know, you just don't know what's going to happen. We were just completely thrilled. And I think that was a really special moment for us because it wasn't just an investment property. It was our first home together. We created a lot of memories and had a lot of friends and family stay there. And then also they saw how they saw the struggle. You know, they saw us. We would use shopper dockets to get ourselves dinner.
I love a good shopper docket.
Yeah, I'm all about the shopper dockets and vouchers and all of that. You know, it wasn't easy. Maybe we made it look easy, but behind the scenes, it wasn't.
When we say it wasn't easy, but you made it look easy, in terms of your budget, how much was going towards paying for the mortgage?
Yeah. I was, I just started in the APS. I was an APS 3 and I was spending more than half of my salary on making the mortgage repayments because in 2007, interest rates were at their peak, like in recent times. They were about 8.88%. Huge. It was about $1,300 a month that I'd have to pay on the mortgage. And it really meant I'm a huge coffee drinker. I love my coffee. It's my it's my thing. I need it. I don't care. I'll buy a good coffee. And I stopped buying coffee, and that was a big deal for me.
So did you stop drinking coffee altogether, or did you go to instant, or did you make your own?
I made my own. So that was definitely a heartbreaking cutback for me.
But it was a short-term sacrifice for a long-term gain.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was playing the long game, and I had hoped that, you know, the property would be our nest egg and that it would you know, give us a return in the future, but you just don't know what's going to happen.
Mm.
Yeah.
Do you still invest in property?
I do, but it's not really my opinion is that I don't really want to sink a lot of my cash into property. I've started to look at also investing in shares and managed funds, but I do own a property in Melbourne, which is an investment property.
Mm-hmm.
And I can almost see it from this beautiful view.
Just to let everyone know, we're sitting on the 35th floor of a new apartment building in South Bank that Neil and I have rented as an Airbnb for 4 days. It's very swish and we do have a beautiful, beautiful view looking out.
It's a three-bedroom apartment on St Kilda Road. And that, again, it's the kind of place where you walked into and you thought, this is nothing special. It kind of looks a bit blah, but something like if you have an eye for a vision or what it could be, that's really a skill that is really valuable if you're interested in property investment, to be able to see what you can manufacture from a property and create something that will really appeal to tenants or another buyer.
I agree with you. We bought this house once that was so run down, it was ridiculous. We had homestay students staying with us at the time, and when we moved there, one of them went and cried on the back deck, and I was thinking, my goodness, what have we done here? Anyway, so I know it was terrible. We had like this green laser light on the back balcony that was falling down, and ornamental grapevines that had gone wild, and it was just crazy. But anyway, we did a lot of work to it and took different walls out and put in a new deck and did a few things. And about 12 months later, a friend came over and she went, wow, what a view. This is so beautiful. She said, did you know it had this view when you bought it? I was thinking, did you not see that view? Like, there was nothing different with the view. But I guess people really do want instant these days, don't they? They want to have that perfect package, perfectly presented properties. They don't always see the potential of what something can be. Come the bricks and mortars. They want that sort of perfect Instagrammable image, like right there and now.
Absolutely. And if you have an eye for style and design and can apply that to a home environment, then for sure that property investing and is something that you could be good at. And I think that we've got all these TV shows about The Block and Selling Houses Australia, where we're constantly shown perfection on different interior designs and things like that. People now, when they walk into a property that they're inspecting, they expect that same thing. And I know that people expect it. It's something I've always spent money on styling a property when I've put it up for sale, because I understand, I value the impact that furniture has in suggesting that lifestyle to a potential buyer.
Yeah, it is important, isn't it? Like, I know when I eventually sold that family home, I actually spent a lot of effort in terms of writing the ad, just because I'm a writer and that's what I do. And we sort of visualized who we thought the ideal family would be. And I was speaking to my mum the night before and I said, well, I think it'll go to a family. What do you think? And she said, a tradie with four kids. And you know who bought it? A tradie with four kids.
Oh.
His wife loved it.
There you go.
And that's what I had in mind, like, because it had been such a beautiful family home for us, and wrote about the lovely neighbours and the quiet cul-de-sac where kids can ride their bicycles. Now, that's probably not the same sort of buyer for someone on St Kilda Road in urban Melbourne, but you have to think, who is the person who's going to want to live here, and what are the reasons? And then to make that really obvious so that they can walk into a room and say, that's going to be a nursery, that's going to be the parents' retreat, that's going to be where my kids are going to ride their bicycles, or that's going to be where I'm going to cook awesome meals and have all my friends over for dinner and just kind of hang out.
Yeah, absolutely. After the Sydney apartment that I bought with my friend, a few years later I bought an apartment off the plan in Waterloo. At the time, I walked into one of those display suites where you're sold the dream, the vision, and the lifestyle.
The colour scheme.
Yep, the colour scheme. And you're looking at the tiny little model apartment block and, oh, this is your apartment right here. And I walked away that day and I thought, oh, gosh, it seems like a lot of money to spend on an apartment off the plan. But it also is very tempting when you're looking to buy a place. And at the time, I'm still trying to build my education about property investing or building my financial wealth and all of that. I was trying different things. I wasn't saying that this is the right decision for all of that. It was just that this was in front of me right now and I needed to decide whether this was going to be part of my journey or not. And the next day I walked home from work and I thought, it's a lot of money and we don't really have the money to buy the place. But I think that we can really make it work if we really want to do this. This was with my partner at the time and I. And we did. We bought the place. We rented it out as an investment. And we sold it about 3 years later. So we bought it for about $650,000. And we sold it for $960,000.
Well done.
And again, I mean, that was a very different situation. That was... We didn't put a lick of paint on those walls. We didn't spend any money on it, but it was about riding the wave in the market at the time. So we were very lucky.
And a lot of research and good timing and taking that risk too.
Yeah.
You touched briefly on relationships. Obviously, it wasn't just you who was buying on it at that time. How easy is it to talk finances and investment when you're in a relationship?
That's a good question. I think that I do feel embarrassed to talk because I'm so interested in finances and money and good deals and all of that stuff. I'm so interested in that. And I don't want to scare, I don't want to scare people. So I try to drip feed, like I drip feed them little insights onto how I think about things when it comes to money. But I think that in the beginning of any relationship is always going to be an adjustment where you come to the same mindset about how you approach money. And that's really important for, I believe, I think it's really important for any relationship. It's the thing that's going to make or break a relationship.
Well, it's truth, isn't it? It's being prepared to share with vulnerability what's happening. And I think what sort of happened often is in our modern world when we are going out on that dating scene, because it's, you know, these days people do often tend to meet online. I mean, people still often do meet the traditional way, although I met my husband, Neil, online. And when you do meet for the first time, you're often trying to portray and project a really affluent, abundant image of yourself. Like, you don't want to put yourself out there and go, oh, look, I've got credit card debt and I've got this and, you know, I've got paying lots of money to my ex and it's all a bit of a mess and I'm not coping. You want to go, I've got a successful job, I've got it all together, I own a house, or I'm wanting to own a house, got a successful business. So it is really difficult to have those kind of conversations honestly about money because you're trying to impress the other person.
Yeah, you are. And that's a really good point because I think that you, in order to have an open discussion about it, you've got to be honest with them about your situation. Talking about, that's always something I think about, Serena, when talking about what your responsibilities are, what important things that are in your life that you want them to know about and to understand. And I remember having a conversation like that with my former partner, talking to them about where I see my future and how important it was to me. And why that was important for him to understand for our relationship. And it wasn't like I was saying, you either get on board or this is it, you know. But I wanted him to understand that I wasn't trying to make him uncomfortable by talking about this. I was trying to explain that this is for something greater than what you think.
And actually, I think that's more romantic. You know, this is the vision of where you wanted to be as a couple.
Yeah, sometimes the process isn't romantic though, but but what you want to achieve.
Spend less money on this, and I literally need to spend less money on this.
Yeah, ideally, the goal is romantic because I think that's a really deep form of love that you can show someone, because I think that going back, thinking about relationships, I think it's a really, really, it's a true testament to love when you really care for someone so much that you want to make sure that you're transparent about your finances.
I think so too. Neil and I, before we got married, we had a bit of a discussion about whether or not to have a prenup, because I came to the relationship with property. He had some equity from some property that he sold not long after we started dating. But on the face of it, I had more assets and I also had two young children to support. I was kind of like, well, I probably need to protect what I have. But we had a really honest discussion about what we both brought to the relationship, what our goals were, how we'd provide for all of the children we both had. And what we worked out was, because he has such good superannuation, when we actually looked at it, there wasn't actually a huge gap. I think we made a decision that we wouldn't get a prenup, because I also felt too that that really locks you into leading very separate lives financially. Like, you know, what was I going to do, charge him rent for the rest of our marriage? And some people do that, and that's a decision they make for a variety of reasons. But I think we're a lot richer by the fact that we work together as a team. For instance, with me giving up the fact that I had property that I brought that was in my name and just accepting we were now a partnership, then that meant that as a couple, we could decide together to focus on paying off those mortgage, which meant we saved a lot of money over the long term because we were jointly working towards that goal. And then we've just recently refinanced, and so Neil's agreed to be one of the joint borrowers, which meant we could negotiate a much better rate. As a couple working towards the same goals with trust and love and openness, you can achieve great things when you work together.
Yeah, definitely. I think about my own situation about how, so my previous relationship, we were 50-50 with everything. We had separate accounts. And I think in my current relationship now, I take a very different approach because I learned lessons about how that worked or how that didn't work and the impact that that had, because we each had different financial capacities, but we led the same lifestyle because we were together. I didn't want our different financial capacities to impact on our any stress in our lives and things like that. While it might have been the right thing to do at that time in my life, I think now, reflecting on it going forward, I think, well, I want to take a different approach. And this is the great thing about financial management and money management being a constant education that you go through in your life, because it's okay to make different decisions and actually contradict yourself, I suppose.
Well, you know, this is a very important thing. I mean, the Barefoot Investor is quite adamant that for a couple, particularly a married couple, that they should have joint finances. But I do have some female friends who've talked about how they've done that, and they've really ended up being taken to the cleaners, and particularly if there's problem issues such as gambling or just a sense that there's things you can't quite put your finger on it, but you just don't have the same money values, there's something not quite right. There is a role sometimes for having them quite separate.
Yeah.
It really does depend a lot about the nature of your relationship and the types of conversations you're having, the level of trust that's there. I don't think there's one simple answer.
No, there isn't. And I think about a conversation I had with someone who is very much in that situation, has accumulated a lot of credit card debt, personal debt, in a relationship where they're supporting the other partner, the lifestyle of both of them, and they love to have the new of everything, technology, clothes, all of that, has an enormous amount of credit card debt, like 5 or 6 different credit cards, stuffs the bills away, pays the bare minimum, and won't address it, and will definitely not speak to their partner about that, the fact that this is a problem and we need to manage it. I just can't even, I feel like they're living in a different planet to where I'm coming from. And I think, how can they go to sleep at night? For me, I feel like that you're living life as a bit of a fraud, because, and then how that impacts on people around you, because people see you as, you're doing very well, you're very successful, you have the best of everything. But behind the scenes, you're drowning in debt and you're in a relationship, you can't even talk about it and understand that really big adjustments need to be made to your life.
Exactly. Well, thank you so very much for agreeing to speak with me here on this new The Joyful Frugalista podcast. As I mentioned before, I had actually never met Jason before today, and we probably could have talked.
It was an online match.
That's right. Through a mutual friend, actually.
Yes.
But we really could have talked for hours, I think, over some of our shared interests, including property investment, Airbnb, getting the best bargains, including dining out, and finally, relationships. So thank you so very much for sharing.
No, thank you. It's my pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to The Joyful Frugalista with Serena Bird. She actually likes everybody. And of course, sound has been by Neil Hadley. And myself, I'm Joseph McGrail Baitup, the record holder for the Guinness World Records.
You gotta accentuate the positive feeling. Eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative. Don't mess with Mr. In Between.